So this is the sound of rush hour in the morning in Hong Kong. It's 11:35 a.m. There are literally thousands of people moving through the metro. I've just landed in Central, and the silence is overwhelming. There's just this, everyone's looking at their phone, heads down, earphones in, no conversation, virtually nothing. And I'm standing in the midst of probably 3,000 people moving, I don't know, 50 people across, packed. People are looking at me like, why is he talking to himself? But I'm okay with that because I stand out anyway, because I'm one of only very few white faces in the midst of this sea of humanity.
I'm Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia, conversations with Asia's leading movers, shakers, thinkers, and provocateurs. In this episode, our topic is Hong Kong, and my guest is Mark Clifford, Executive Director of the Hong Kong-based Asia Business Council. For 20 years prior, Mark served as lead editor for some of the region's most prestigious news and business publications, including the South China Morning Post, The Standard, Business Week, and the much-admired and now-defunct Far Eastern Economic Review. Mark's been a guest on the program before. We last spoke about Asia's environmental challenges, and he shared with us insights from his book, The Greening of Asia. I asked him back this time to discuss a recent South China Morning Post editorial where he takes a stand for Hong Kong and warns of growing attempts by political forces to curtail the free flow of information. Mark writes, and I quote, "The end of free speech will be the end of Hong Kong as an international financial hub." Given that banking is Hong Kong's life's blood, that's saying something. As a longtime resident, Mark calls Hong Kong home. I asked him to reflect on the changes he's seen and comment on where he thinks Hong Kong is headed.
The editorial came out of the decision by the Hong Kong government to deny a work visa extension for Victor Mallet, who worked for the Financial Times. No reason was given, but it has widely been assumed that it's because of Mr. Mallet's involvement as an officer of the Foreign Correspondents Club in hosting Andy Chan, who is the head of the Hong Kong National Party and espouses pro-independence positions, pro-independence for Hong Kong. He is very much a marginal figure. Independence surprisingly does have support in Hong Kong, much more support than it had 5 years ago when it wasn't on the agenda. But many people believe that the FCC was simply providing a neutral venue for discussion. They'll invite
Foreign Correspondents Club.
Yeah, I'm sorry. The Foreign Correspondents Club was simply doing its job and providing a venue for discussion. They invite people of all political stripes. But Mr. Mallet was very front and center in not backing down on demands by, particularly by C.Y. Leung, the former chief executive of Hong Kong, for the Foreign Correspondents Club to cancel that event. And he was seen to have been punished and paid a price by having his visa, the extension, denied. And so nothing like this has ever happened in Hong Kong that I'm aware of, certainly not during the past 20 years when Hong Kong has been a special administrative region of China. I'm not aware of anything like this happening during the British period, although clearly there was a lot of blacklisting of pro-communist China representatives, but I don't think a work visa was ever denied. So it's a really bad sign. It's a real sign that the freedoms that we've grown used to in Hong Kong are narrowing, that the red lines are being drawn in a tighter and tighter circumference around us.
And just for listeners, Mark, I mean, you know, this is the handover of Hong Kong to the Chinese 20 years ago. Many of us at that point who were journalists and working and watching and observing were concerned that maybe China would meddle to some degree. It hasn't actually been as bad as many of us thought. What would be your assessment?
It hasn't been as bad as many of us have thought, and it hasn't been as good as many people had prophesied. So I think it's Hong Kong is really quite a success in some ways against the odds. My editorial went back to the early 1980s when Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher was visiting her first trip to Hong Kong as Prime Minister, and immediately, just several days after she'd been in Beijing, where Paramount leader Deng Xiaoping told her in no uncertain terms that China would take back control of Hong Kong when the new territory's lease ran out on July 1st, 1997. Thatcher had hoped that British rule might be extended, or even if sovereignty was nominally in China's hands, that British administrative rule could continue. And I came across some documents recently that were secret until relatively recently, describing in quite candid and blunt terms the Hong Kong business community's meeting with Thatcher. And at that time, some very prominent Chinese businessmen, Hong Kong Chinese businessmen, expressed the fear about China, hopes that British rule would continue. And then sort of almost 40 years on, those fears look prophetic because China is very much tightening the grip. On the other hand, we're 21 plus years into Chinese rule. This is definitely the freest city in China. It's one of the freest cities in Asia. We have, by all accounts, you know, we've got a good government, a clean government. We have phenomenal infrastructure. We have fairly free press. The issue with Mr. Mallet notwithstanding, we have very, very robust local press, sort of no holds barred local media, and despite pressure on them. So it's a mixed picture. We don't have one person, one vote democracy, but there's a lot of civil liberty, and it's a safe, well-run city that also happens to be one of the greatest international financial centers in the world.
And the Chinese business elite, being who they are pragmatists. So many who might have had early concerns, not knowing, you know, in any changeover is concerning, came around for the most part. In many cases, I would say most of them have profited by closer integration with the mainland. And I'd say, you know, as anything I can see, it looks like there's hope and expectations that the relationship will continue to thrive. In 50 years from the time of turnover, that's when it becomes fully integrated with China. Is that right?
That's right. In 2047, it doesn't have to become fully integrated. The expectation is that it will, although some pro-Chinese people say that there's no reason why the special status, the special administrative region status that we enjoy can't continue. So to underscore how different we are from the rest of China, Hong Kong has its own currency. We drive on the left side of the road. Hong Kong drives on the right side of the road. Hong Kong drivers are on the left side of the road. Chinese drivers are on the right side of the road. And this is a very real logistical issue because we've just built a bridge connecting us with China. And halfway across the bridge, you have to switch directions. So this does have some real issues. We have our own tax system. We have our own legal system. We have the British common law tradition, and China has its own legal system. So, you know, we are very, very separate. On the other hand, we're a tiny little kind of rounding error in China, 7 million people on sort of the rump of the Chinese coast in a country of 1.4 billion people. We're not even really a rounding error. And yet, we are the freest city in China. We are a global international financial center. We have free flow of capital, which China doesn't. As I said, we have our own currency, our own taxes, our own system. So, you know, it's quite a remarkable, and I think probably untenable position in the long term for us to be so different and so separate, particularly from a country that's run by a one-party state.
Yeah. And yet here there is this, and you just alluded to it, this high-speed train, which is now open between here and Guangzhou, infrastructure, bridges. There's talk of a Greater Bay Area, which is new to me. Tell us a little bit about what the Greater Bay Area means for the Hong Kong Chinese and the mainland.
Well, the Greater Bay Area is obviously a reference to the Bay Area and Silicon Valley and the hopes that the Chinese leadership have that China can enter a new period of technology-driven growth. And Shenzhen, which borders Hong Kong and was a special economic zone, is where all the economic reforms really started. And actually, if we go back historically, Southern China has always, it's obviously a long way from Beijing. It's a long way from the capital. It's where the old China trade was based in Canton, now known as Guangzhou. And it's always been more open to the rest of the world. In fact, the reason that Hong Kong exists as a colony is that it was a war spoil fought over the right to trade more freely in southern China. In fact, it was fought after the Chinese seized illegal opium from the British traders. So there's a historical reason for thinking about southern China as a you know, a very dynamic and very open place. The hopes of the leaders now are that Hong Kong and the other special administrative region, Macau, which is the old Portuguese colony just on the west side of the Delta, can be more fully integrated into the whole Pearl River Delta and the nine major cities there, of which Guangzhou is the capital. A big part of this is physical infrastructure. You mentioned the high-speed train. In October, President Xi Jinping opened the world's longest sea bridge that goes from Hong Kong over to Macau and Zhuhai on the western side of the Delta. So the infrastructure is being built. It's easy to go into Shenzhen from Hong Kong. That didn't used to be the case, but there's still a hard border, and it's that border is there for political reasons. I think that no one in Hong Kong wants that border to come down, because people in Hong Kong look up and they see 1.4 billion Chinese people who want to come in and buy apartments and ride on the MTR with heavy packages and buy milk powder because it's safe here and you can't trust it in China, and just want to come and take over Hong Kong. And so I think Hong Kong people, and this gets back to the independence issue, Hong Kong people, on the one hand, are very proud, I think, of being part of being Chinese and of everything that the Chinese government has accomplished. And on the one hand, they're terrified of being swamped by 1.4 billion people who are, after all, part of a country that's ruled by a Leninist party.
Yeah. Soft power is playing out, though, in the property market here in Hong Kong, because, you know, just like you pointed out, property prices in Hong Kong are at astronomical levels, which actually leads me to some concerns about the future viability of Hong Kong as a financial commercial center, because the costs are so high. Are you concerned about that, or is the Hong Kong government doing anything to try to prevent this?
This is issue number one. It is a political issue that plays out in almost every newspaper, every day, every conversation that people have. They are, by many accounts, the world's highest. And this in a city where the median wage is only about $2,000 US a month. And so it makes it very, very difficult, particularly for young people, to have any hope that they can ever get a place of their own. Now, there's an interesting safety valve, which is that almost half of people live in either public housing, government housing, or some form of subsidized housing. And so there is a kind of pressure release valve. But I think people feel very unhappy that their city is being taken care of and taken over, and that they're being priced out of the property market because of some small portion of the 1.4 billion mainland Chinese people decide Hong Kong's a good place where you can move money in and out easily, and there's a lot more freedom. And so they feel like they're losing their city. But to your bigger point about whether or not Hong Kong will be priced out, I think that's a real issue, because it's very hard to start up businesses. You can't get space. It's very hard to run businesses. If you're successful, the landlord wants more rent from you. If you're not successful, they just shutter you and you move on.
Which kind of brings me back to the Greater Bay Area Nine Cities idea, this mass integration of southern China, where there's cheaper real estate just, you know, 15, 20, 25 minutes away. You know, Shenzhen, we talked about when you know, in the day. I was there first in 1989. You said, early 1993, 94, you were there. These were mud flats, industrial parks with the occasional cement building. You know, foreign joint ventures popping up just because the tax situation and the preferential treatment was so good. Shenzhen and that whole area is entirely different today. You just came back. Tell us a little bit about what that looks like.
Well, Shenzhen is now home to two of the world's 10 tallest buildings. It is linked to Hong Kong and then beyond into China as part of the high-speed rail network. There are things such as a new park that's being built there that's about twice the size of Central Park. And the winner of that, an American and Turkish architectural firm, were just awarded the prize to do that contract in July, and it's supposed to be done next July. So the Shenzhen speed is just unbelievable. There are massive new factories, very capital-intensive factories being built, because it's no longer cheap labor. And by the way, in terms of property prices are not that much cheaper in Shenzhen than they are in Hong Kong. And so you're seeing just a dramatic rise in living standards and technological productivity in southern China. And I think that in some ways, this really is the future. This is, by many accounts, the world's largest urban megalopolis with 60 million plus people when you include Hong Kong, Macau, and the nine cities of the Greater Bay Area. And as we see the transportation and infrastructure links built out, as we see more capital and some of the smartest people in the world working at some of these companies, I just think the place is going to boom and boom and boom economically.
This is Inside Asia. My guest is Mark Clifford, Executive Director of the Asia Business Council and former Editor-in-Chief of the South China Morning Post. We're talking about Hong Kong. Stay with us. I'm Steve Stein, and you're listening to my conversation with Mark Clifford, Executive Director of the Asia Business Council and an Asia media and publishing veteran. We've been discussing Hong Kong and the changes that the newly opened sea bridge to the mainland have started to bring about. In the second part of our conversation, I asked him to say something about the tech companies that have located there. His response came as a surprise.
Let me start with a different sort of company, which is a finance company, Ping An Finance, which has the Ping An Finance Center opened earlier in 2018. It's, I believe, 118 stories tall, fourth tallest building in the world. Ping An was an insurance company started by a guy who was a driver during the Cultural Revolution. I think he'd been a peasant, a guy, Mr. Ma, still running the company, and it's one of the world's largest financial institutions now. And it's not just an insurance company, it's actually leading a revolution in fintech, and it's been seeding, helping to fund startups throughout the fintech industry in China, which poses danger to incumbents throughout China. The old lumbering state-owned banks are going to find it hard to compete with some of the technology-driven, financially innovative companies that are able to make credit decisions, give loans more quickly and more efficiently and with fewer losses than some of the traditional players. So that's a sort of out-of-the-box example. But then you have companies like Tencent, which is one of the largest gaming, AI, just tech companies in the world. It's got a market valuation in the neighborhood of $400 billion. It's, you know, for a while earlier this year, was one of the 10 largest market cap companies in the world. Again, huge, soaring new headquarters in Shenzhen. Companies like Huawei, the telecoms company, TCL, which is a TV appliance electronics company. They're partway through a $25 billion U.S. dollar capital spending program to build new screen factories. Everything from big TV screens to little phone screens. I mean, they're competing with the Samsungs of the world.
You know, these are four great examples, because all of those organizations are attempting to go global. Yet there are constraints imposed by the Chinese government on ability of allowing these companies to send their capital overseas. How will they contend with that? And what are some of the issues that they're facing on this? Because the free flow of capital is an important thing if you want to truly be a global player.
Well, I think there are quite significant challenges as Chinese companies try to go abroad. First of all, they have a large, very large domestic market. And I think many of them are going to do just fine staying within that domestic market. But companies like Huawei, Tencent, TCL, are all global companies. And beyond the very real issue of capital that you have highlighted, I think there are also softer issues. Companies that grew up in one market don't always know how to translate, let's say, the Chinese experience to India or to Indonesia. And I think we're seeing some stumbles in that regard, although I think given the trade disputes with the U.S., as well as the current push to go out within Asia, the so-called Belt and Road Initiative, that we're going to continue to see Chinese investment and Chinese companies trying to go abroad. They won't all succeed, but some of them will over time. I think there are going to be a lot of stumbles. I think where they're really going to run into trouble or more challenges is simply the Sino-U.S. trade war. It looks like it's not just a little minor skirmish. It looks like this could be the start of a new Cold War. And yet, it's not like the old Cold War because we are much more technologically, economically, business intertwined than the U.S. and the Soviet Union were. But if you're Huawei and you have the U.S. government basically telling companies not to buy Huawei equipment, that's pretty bad in terms of trying to get into the U.S. market. And it also means it's difficult to go into Canada and probably a lot of other NATO markets. So I think there's some big, big political issues that, you know, even a year ago wouldn't have really been on the horizon.
Well, it's, you know, looking at this area and its growth and its development and the infrastructure and the advanced deployment of everything from road systems to metros to mass transportation systems, it is a shining example of what China is capable of from an infrastructure position. And it starts to make some of the big cities of Europe and the U.S. look a bit shabby, doesn't it?
Well, I think there's the advantage that newer cities have. They just have newer infrastructure. So in Hong Kong, the metro line, the first line just opened in 1979. So it's all pretty new. You know, New York, it's a 100-plus-year-old system. Same thing with London. And it's just, you know, there is the advantage of newness. We'll see how well all of these things age. But you mentioned the high-speed rail before. I mean, it's an incredible, you know, many thousands of kilometers of high-speed train. I mean, really high-speed train, 300 kilometers plus. And it's extraordinary what China's done on the infrastructure side. I think the big challenge is having gotten this close to the technology frontier, how does China start pushing the technology frontier? Not just play catch up anymore, not just play copycat. I mean, China has had the advantage of being able to take technology, whether high speed train technology from Japan or electronics technology from other Asian countries. I mean, a lot of that technology has been developed. And one of the great, I think, examples or one of the great benefits of globalization is the fact that ideas and technologies have been transmitted in this post-1945 period much, much more quickly than they were before. And that's benefited, well, in China's case, more than 600 million people have come out of absolute poverty. So really, when we're talking about development, it's nice to look at the shiny stuff like high-speed trains and big, tall buildings. But what it's really about is pulling people out of poverty and giving parents the chance to send their kids to school, being able to take their kids to the doctor when they're sick. And I think China's done a remarkable job on that, but it needs to keep going. And I think the issue is if you're in an increasingly restrictive one-party state, how do you then promote creativity? And China wants to have it both ways. Hey, maybe they can do it, but I think the jury's still out.
Well, it's interesting because I recently spoke with Bill Overholt, who's written a book about this, and he said, you know, for years back at the time when he said, no, I think China can do this without the political reforms, everyone said, it's impossible. There's no possible. And he was right on that. He looked at Korea and Taiwan and other markets. But he is now arguing that, in fact, for it to go the next stage, it must have political reforms, that it must have greater liberalization. Now, that's a pretty strong position for Bill, given that he's played, you know, a certain position for so long. But do you feel that that's true, that that's the case? Or can they continue to push forward with top-down directives that will at least allow the greater number of people, if not everybody, to gain some benefit from the process of capitalization and free market?
Well, first of all, I think Bill Overholt is an extremely astute analyst. And when his book about the rise of China came out in the early 1990s, a lot of people scoffed at it because it seemed way too optimistic. And in fact, in retrospect, it was not nearly optimistic enough. And yet Bill was way out there on the bullish spectrum. So I take what he says very seriously. But like any bull market, what China's been doing can go on a lot longer than people think. So I'm not going to say they must have political reform or they must do this or must do that. What I would say, though, is that they're going to start facing some demographic headwinds on top of these technology frontier issues that I've mentioned. So on the one hand, they've gotten pretty much as far as they can in terms of catching up as a result of cheap labor, cheap land, cheap capital. I mean, they've underpriced the three major inputs. And at the same time, they've been able to get technology and get know-how from other countries. They've borrowed it, they've bought it, they've begged for it, they've stolen it, they've done all that. And by the way, the U.S. has done this, and pretty much every country that's playing catch-up has done that.
Important to mention that. Yeah.
That's what late industrializers do. Everybody except the U.K., the original industrializer, did that. So Fair enough. But okay, here we are in 2018. The population is aging dramatically. The number of new entrants into the workforce peaked a couple years ago. In some ways, that's good. Wages are going up. You've got to pay a lot more attention to your inputs. You have to be more capital intensive, but you have to be smarter too. And I think as the population ages, the dependency ratio, the population that's older, that's not working increases, and you're not playing catch up as much with this cheap labor, cheap land, cheap capital inputs, it's just going to get a lot harder. And I think that the fact that Xi Jinping has not reformed, has not taken his first 5 years of reform, and in fact has rolled back reforms, have strengthened state-owned enterprises, have made life in many ways more difficult even for the largest private companies, does not augur well for the future. And I think nobody can ever predict when a crisis is going to come, how it's going to happen. But I find it very telling that China seems so spooked that the stock markets this year have been so weak as a result of what? I mean, sure, export growth has slowed down a little bit. The U.S. is being a little tougher. But the reaction of the Chinese leadership that's something close to panic really makes me wonder what they know that I don't. So I don't like to predict anything, but I think Bill is right to point out that there are some vulnerabilities in the system.
Maybe it's just, you know, it's like economic heroin. If you're on 10% plus per annum growth rates and they fall to six or seven, that feels like an absolute avalanche. But in fact, maybe it's not. Maybe it's just a readjustment period. I am interested, though, on how much those operating southern China are feeling the pinch or feeling the fear of a trade war with the U.S. Do they feel that that's going to break the back of what's been done so far, or is just going to be a period of maybe a little bit of a retrenchment until they kind of rebuild?
Well, I think the Chinese are actually more negative than I am. I think there are a lot of people who are just really concerned that this is somehow going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back. I don't think China's fundamentally that weak. To your point about sort of we're at, 6.8% growth now, and it feels like a dramatic deceleration. When I was in Korea in the early 1990s, after the Olympics in 1988, the economy slowed dramatically. And I think it was at just under 6%, and the then president, No Tae-woo, declared it a total crisis. Now, the Koreans would feel like they were in heaven if they ever had 6% again. I mean, China's probably going towards 3% growth over the next decade. I mean, that's just going to happen. And by 2030, they're going to have the demographic structure more or less of what Germany's is today. They've got to get smart and fast. And I don't mean that the Chinese aren't smart. I mean, they have to think about a new way of doing business. They've got to, for example, the service sector is woefully unproductive. And they need to open up a lot of sectors. But they're very, very concerned about the social and political and labor consequences of doing that. I think at some point they're going to have to be a little bolder with reform. And the interesting thing about Xi Jinping is, for all his political boldness in terms of centralizing power, he hasn't really shown what he wants to do with it. He hasn't really done anything sort of dramatic. And people tend to act when there's a crisis and they really need to act. And again, I don't want to predict that a crisis is coming, but it's interesting how spooked people tend to feel at the moment. Your issue about financial heroin is interesting, because we've seen a dramatic increase in debt overall in the Chinese economy since 2008. And they had the world's biggest stimulus program, close to $600 billion, and just a lot of debt that went into the economy. So debt as a percentage of GDP is well over 200%. And hey, look, the U.S. and other countries have this problem, too. I think the entire world has injected a lot of debt into the system since 2008. I don't really see the Chinese plan to delever. And in fact, they have seemingly dialed back on their more aggressive plans to reduce debt. So that's concerning. Now, personally, I think that this is likely to push China more quickly to increase productivity and to increase domestic demand. And I think we all know that China has been very investment focused, and capital investment, whether it's in infrastructure or new factories, has been a lot of the economic juice that's driven things for the last couple decades. Their consumers need to be spending more. That's good for quality of life. It may be a disaster for the environment. We'll leave that aside. But in terms of just macroeconomic standpoint, it'll be good for their consumers to be spending more. And I actually think that the U.S. trade thing is going to push them to do more and more quickly. And I think they're going to do more on the technology front. This Made in China 2025 might go away in terms of a name because the U.S. has really seized on it as a kind of nationalist program. I think it's going to push them to localize a lot more technologies more quickly.
So China pivoting from export-led to domestic growth. And it's interesting that you raise that with Xi Jinping, because you're right, he spent most of his time consolidating power, the iron grip, we will control and manage this, through this crisis. But you would have expected at this point for him to start to sell, buy China, right? To just the way that we did buy America years ago to get ourselves out of the recession. You kind of expect that there's a moment that this is going to happen, but it hasn't really been articulated that way, has it?
I think it's happening, but it hasn't been articulated from the top levels. But I think what we're seeing in terms of particularly technologies, for all my caveats earlier about the difficulty of pushing beyond the technology frontier, the trade war, and also the sort of almost shutdown of the big telecoms company ZTE that Trump almost put out of business earlier this year, I think has really focused the minds of the Chinese leadership to the fact that they don't control their technological future. Companies like Qualcomm and some of the big chip makers are really key to what China does. So there's all this talk about a trade deficit on the U.S. side vis-a-vis China, but the stuff that China buys from the U.S., it really needs, and it doesn't really have an economy without a lot of those inputs. So a full-fledged trade war that would really see, let's say, just for argument's sake, the kind of embargo that the U.S. put on Japan just before World War II would be a disaster for the Chinese economy. I think they were expecting confrontation with the U.S., but they thought they'd have another 10 years. This just pushes up the program, and I think behind the scenes, we're going to just see a real acceleration of trying to control their technological future more fully.
Mark, from your vantage point here in Hong Kong, we thank you so much. Wonderful comments and insights, and we hope to see you again.
Always great talking to you, Steve, and look forward to the next time.
This is Inside Asia, and you've been listening to my conversation with Mark Clifford, Executive Director of the Asia Business Council and a former chief editor of the South China Morning Post, The Standard, and Business Week. At the end of every show, I leave listeners with a thought or two of my own, a summing up of the key takeaways from the conversation you've just heard. In this Asia Insider Minute, I'm left with several thoughts. Here goes. Let's start by asking what impact the newly opened and world's longest sea bridge linking Hong Kong to the mainland is going to have. On the one hand, the bridge is paving the way for a new Greater Bay Area, an intentional wordplay on the other Bay Area, the one across the Pacific and home to Silicon Valley. The project is the brainchild of Chinese Communist Party planners who believe that by indelibly linking Hong Kong to 10 South China cities, they can incite a tech and development revolution. It's a glittering 21st century set of megacities with a chrome-plated infrastructure to match, an engineering feat ambitious enough to make Ayn Rand blush. Who, you might ask, would ever choose New York's rickety and decaying underground to Hong Kong's MTR or mass transit railway? It's a system that moves with brisk and clinical efficiency. You will find no Dean Street stop on the Hong Kong subway. And for those of you who don't recognize Dean Street, it's the name of the Brooklyn subway stop first opened in 1897, closed in 1899, reopened in 1901, and closed again in 1995. In short, Dean Street is legacy. The rail system linking the Greater Bay Area, or GBR, is not. It's new, fast, and efficient. There are no wrong turns, no phantom stations, no transportation patches in the GBR. Why? Because it was all planned from scratch. But is it enough to fulfill the dreamy-eyed visions of Chinese planners who eat steel and cement for breakfast? For Mark Clifford, he thinks not. Or to be more precise, he puts more stock in the free flow of information than in the free flow of mass transit. In many ways, China is simply doing what China does best, building stuff. But what happens, asks Mark, when the country exhausts the three cheap inputs, labor, land, and capital, that till now have powered decades of double-digit growth rates? As it were, the slowing has begun, and now the real proof of economic power lies in wait. Filling glittering office towers and condominiums with knowledge workers and innovators who see past a manufacturing and export culture to the fourth industrial revolution, now that's the real trick. Change is in the wind. Surely the Chinese have known this, just as they must have known that a trade war with the U.S. was on the horizon. How prepared really is the South China workforce to toggle from export-led to import-driven? Is there enough slack in the domestic economy to get behind a new generation of software developers, robotics engineers, data scientists, and entrepreneurs? There's a bit of bait and switch that has to take place to convince the world and the Chinese themselves that this kind of rapid transformation is possible. The $15 billion, 55-kilometer-long Hong Kong-Zhuhai-Macau Bridge may be emblematic of the challenge. Because of Hong Kong's colonial past, cars drive on the left. In China, they drive on the right. To limit potential chaos, not all drivers will be allowed to travel the length of the bridge, but some will. For those granted the privilege, a crossover point exists midway, and there, we suspect, adaptation will prove the key. It involves a whole different way of thinking, a new mindset. It's not easy, but that's the price of innovation. Until next time, I'm Steve Stein saying, coming from the outside on Inside Asia. We thank you for listening.